There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go. We're qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Fall, my co-host. Nasser Hamid will be bringing us Motorsports Mondial in the second part of the show. This is podcast number 490, March 17th, 2011. Stephen?
This F1Weekly podcast is brought to you by the donation button. Yes, you know the donation button. It's right there on the homepage, right there in the upper left-hand corner. Haven't been seeing too many people there lately. Check it out. You know you want to.
Thank you, Stephen. On today's program, Braun says forward exhaust is the way to go. Bernie thinks Australia is as good as Monaco. Schumacher convinced podiums is in his future. And, of course, big deal signing at Red Bull. Vettel extends his contract till 2014 for millions and millions of dollars. And, of course, Motorsports Mondial with the guru himself. And special repeat interview, Mario Andretti. Stephen, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Wonderful, Mr. Rogers and yourself.
Absolutely wonderful. Everything's fine here. Of course, some strange stuff happening all over the world. If it's not Bahrain going down, it's Japan going down.
Or Libya on fire.
Yeah, but we'll see what happens. But anyway, there's still Formula One. We've got like 10 days to go, gentlemen, ladies.
Woo-hoo-hoo.
Finally, the Australian Grand Prix. And, you know, I cannot wait to get this season started.
Yeah, especially after being postponed. Looking forward to it.
No, it's going to be great. And, of course, Bernie Eccleston came out and said that the Australian Grand Prix is as important as Monaco.
Yeah, but, you know, if you don't want to buy it, that's okay. You know, you don't have to buy it. You don't have to buy it. You know, we only give you worldwide television coverage. But you don't have to buy it because I'm not lowering my price for, you know, you because you're important like Monaco.
Bernie says, it's part of the World Championship and has been for an awful long time. We'd hate to think that we're going to lose Australia. In the case of Melbourne, if the product is too expensive, we understand. When the contract comes to an end, there's no need to renew it. We wouldn't force somebody to buy something that they don't want or think is too expensive. That's Bernie.
Okay, so what other choices are there? And, you know, is Bernie going to let them take it to Adelaide or, you know, Alton Park or one of the other? Alton Park's in England.
It's in the UK.
But one of the other tracks down under?
I don't know. I have no clue. I think it will stay because it's a popular race. The atmosphere is electric. Even though Australia does have some problems, especially after the floods. I don't know. But we'll see what happens. And, you know, Bernie thinks it's as important as Monaco. So,
well, it's a populous continent. If you really want a true world championship, you know, you kind of need to be on that continent at least once.
Well, we've said that about the United States, but...
Well, we're still in North America, so he could cheat on that one.
You think? That's true.
But when John Tott uses populous country, then we start going, dude, you know, work the continent angle instead, because if that's the case, then why hasn't there been a race in the United States for the last 3 years?
Yeah. But anyway, I'm happy that... Australia is going to be the season opener. I'm sorry for what happened in Bahrain, and right now the way it looks with the Saudi,
it's still really
army going into Bahrain to squelch the problems.
The 3-month state of emergency kind of really makes it a bit of a challenge to try to put the race on at any time this year.
I agree. I don't think there's going to be a Bahrain GP this year, but let's move on. Ross Braun's come out. You know, and I mentioned the forward exhaust, the blown floor from Renault being fairly exciting, but then I'm somewhat biased.
Yeah.
But Ross Braun believes that the introduction of the forward exhaust will have more significant impact than double diffusers had during the 2009 season. And if anybody knows about the double diffuser, he does.
Yep.
So I'm pretty excited. He says that it is a significant area and maybe some more significant than the double diffuser in terms of performance. And, of course, the teams are all working with their engine partners to work out how to get the most out of the exhaust energy so that it is the new interesting area of development in the upcoming months. And we're going to see a lot of teams going with this. And I think McLaren, with the MP426 and, of course, some of the whining from Jenson Button and Hamilton, you know, they came out with those strange side pods. I don't think they're going to last, but we'll see what happens.
Depends on what they end up doing on a track instead of in testing.
Instead of testing. I agree, but both drivers at McLaren are not too excited about the MP426, but we'll see what happens. Fernando Alonso has come out and said that he is definitely not writing off one of his
McLaren is, you know, one of the strongest engineering teams in the championship. You know, if they maybe they start the season a little behind, they'll get it in gear and catch back up. They always do.
Absolutely. And the biggest thing that we're going to be seeing and we're going to be watching when the first, when practice starts on Friday, coming up soon, is the Pirelli tires doing official business.
Oh, I was going to be watching the wing that I learned today is not adjustable anytime you want. It's
only when you're with at certain points in time.
Yeah, certain spots of the track when you're within a certain distance from the guy in front of you. What's the use?
It's so complicated. It is absolutely ridiculous. But yes, there's safety concerns, Stephen. And that's why they're implementing these certain time rules for the movable rear wing. But, I mean, you know, we didn't see that much excitement when we had the movable front wing.
Yeah.
I think the KERS, and who has issues with KERS, even though it was fairly dependable back in 2009. So, I don't think it's going to be a big problem, depending on who goes with what kind of KERS system. But still, for me, I think the Pirellis are the biggest
Are going to be the biggest factor at the start of the season. And I'm hoping that we don't end up with an Australian Grand Prix that was like the Bahrain Grand Prix last year, where the teams are playing so tight because they don't want to make a mistake with the new rules.
Well, I mean, there's going to be some tightness. It takes a while to loosen up. It takes a couple of races at least.
Yep. So yet another reason to get the rules.
We're going to see some interesting strategies, some conservative strategies, and of course, the allocation of the Pirelli compounds, what they're going to have in Australia, and the temperature of the track in Australia, because we really haven't had any hot weather testing on the Pirellis.
And we know that Australia can be one end or the other of the scale.
Exactly, but Pirelli has been talking a lot, and they say, as far as we're concerned, we are delivering what we were asked to do, which was to try and create multiple pit stops. Two stops were what we were aiming for, and what we are probably looking at an average of 3 at the moment. But that will be verifying going onward. There have been many years where the sport has had multiple tire and fuel stops, and many great races have been had when people have been a bit brighter with their strategy. So in other words, they're blah-blahing, saying, really, if you don't like what's going to happen, don't blame the tires. They're sort of giving themselves a little loophole here because they're going to say, you know what? No matter what tire compound you have, it's all going to come down to team strategies and good decision making.
Exactly. And it's always what it is. You can't blame the tire. You know, You can't blame the tires when everybody's using the same tires.
Correct.
It's like, you know, it's a more a matter of how well you're able to conserve them, how good your pit stops are, you know, in making smart moves with your strategies. You know, people whining about it. You know, I would rather see races with two pit stops. I thought races with a single pit stop were lame.
I didn't like the single pit stops either, especially when you went 55 laps, you did your mandatory pit stop, and then you went in and finished the race.
Yeah, I was not a fan of, you know, oh, we've got two compounds. Okay, one of these will last two-thirds of a race. The other one will last a half a race. So, hey.
Yes, I agree. And I think Pirelli will spot. I think it's going to be a little more exciting than what Bridgestone had to offer last season. Also, Pirelli is requesting Pedro De La Rosa to come back. Come back, Pedro. Por favore.
Come back, Pedro.
So, because, you know,
we'll pay you more.
We know Pedro's signed a contract with McLaren. He's now their test driver again and again and again. But Pirelli still is looking for some testers. It's not that easy, and especially with somebody with some experience who's already tested and they can give him some feedback.
What about Alex Wurz?
Sure, yeah, but see, Pedro's already tested the Pirellis. Nick Heidfeld was tested, but obviously Nick is a full-time driver this year. And what they're doing is they've made some modifications to the Toyota, the TF109, for this year to increase the downforce. And having driven the car last year, Pedro, I would like Pedro to compare them. After that, I think it would create problems with the other teams if it weren't, if it went forward, blah, 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 because, you know, everybody doesn't want to think that maybe McLaren will be getting a leg up if Pedro is doing this testing for Pirelli. So we'll see what happens if he actually gets to do it. But in the end, no, I think the Pirellis are going to be the big question mark.
To Toyota, get Ralph.
Ralph, yeah. Ralph is probably available.
I think he's looking for a job.
He's still in DTM. You know, he's a big attraction. He's a Schumacher. Fernando Alonso, he concurs with everybody else and with Steve that the best car will still win this year's championship despite tire strategies being highlighted as one of the vital factors to enjoy a successful season.
Because the best car is going to be the one that uses the tires the best.
Yes. Well, it's going to be the smoothest driver, too. Yeah, Mr. Smooth.
Well, he who can basically
Keystone
who can do what needs to be done to save tire wear. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think there's going to be some interesting concepts going on at McLaren because we know Hamilton is much more aggressive than Jenson Button. Jenson Button can get the longevity needed out of a set of tires most of the time. Not all of the time. But it's going to be very interesting how, you know, somebody like Kamui Kobayashi, who's...
Yeah, well, you've got a couple of teams where you've got a pair of drivers that are kind of in that mode because, you know, Sebastian Vettel's a bit hard on tires where Mark Webber can
Sebastian really... Vettel's hard on cars.
Exactly. But where Mark Webber can really baby us, you know, we saw him baby that set last year that was like, what?
And now that Sebastian Vettel is making a lot more money than Mark Webber...
Yeah, Mark Webber's all up, but it's going to be all very interesting.
There'll be some motivational factors there as well. But no, I am looking forward to seeing this season start in Australia. It's going to be exciting. Any predictions, Steve? What do you think is going to happen out there? Nick Heidfeld on pole? Renault wins? Woohoo!
You know, it's possible. The Renaults look good in testing, but, you know, so did the Sauber last week, too. So it's going to be really interesting to get through practice and see what kind of times people start posting on the Albert Park circuit and then see how people qualify out. That's going to be really, you know, you almost can't not bet on the Red Bulls just because they've been so dominant.
Well, obviously, you have the Red Bulls are going to be
in the mix. It's just who's going to be up there with them.
I think it's going to be Vettel going for pole for sure. He's going... he's excited. He's got the millions of dollars now. He's got the number one on the car. He's got the commercials all over Germany.
He's got a new contract to take him through. You know.
He is the Wunderkinder.
Wunderkinder.
So, it's exciting. I mean, you got to, you know, you put yourself in his shoes and he is the dude.
That dude.
So, I'm happy for them. Now, there was some interesting stuff coming out of people that I usually respect highly, Steven.
Uh-oh.
And I think John Tutt is doing a marvelous job as the FIA president.
I like the fact that he's not in the press every week.
He's not in the press every week, and he's not in the dungeon every weekend. As far as we know.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's very interesting. He's got a new concept to make the drivers more visible, and people can remember them easier when they just see a number. For instance, let me test your memory. In NASCAR, number 8 is?
Well, it used to be Dale Earnhardt.
Isn't it? Dale Earnhardt Jr., number 3.
No, he's in 88 now.
Oh, is it an 8? See,
they took 8, because when he left his mother's team, he couldn't take the number with him.
Well, see, that's how much I know, Stephen. So keep up the good work. Well, anyway.
I do know that that 24 is Jeff Gordon.
Thank you very much. 24 is Jeff Gordon. So anyway, and as they move, you know, these guys keep their number, unlike
in most
being
cases,
assigned a number. Your number doesn't change depending on how you finish the season.
Right.
Only your pocketbook changes. Anyway, Jean Todt is hoping to introduce a more visible car number in a bid to improve the show for Formula One viewers. He says, it's very difficult to identify a driver in a car. I would like to see who is driving the car from a long distance and the number of the car. So like in NASCAR, a driver who is arriving in Formula One, he gets a number. He would keep it for all of his career. You could identify a driver with a number. At the moment, you don't find the number. You don't find the name. I think it's a great point. It works in America. It works in NASCAR. They don't do that in the IRL, I don't believe.
No, I don't believe so either.
But very interesting. I like it because Jean Todt is keeping an open mind.
No, I think they should just have like holographic projectors over the top of the car that, you know, has this big helmet with their number on the side.
Well,
of
not only that, but they should. I love in NASCAR when they have the pointer and the other pointer.
That's cool, though. I like it.
And there goes Danica. So, I'm not fooling around here, Stephen.
Yes, you are.
I think Jean Todt may be onto something huge.
Okay, the question becomes, how do you assign the numbers to the guys that are already in? But you couldn't let go, okay, your number now is the number you have this season.
Well, not only that, but what if Schumacher wants number 4 and Fernando Alonso wants number 4?
Well, some of that would be, you'd have to go with some kind of seniority type of situation.
Yeah, well, the problem is with superstition and everything else, it would be interesting, but it won't work simply because it's used in NASCAR. And these people are above that, Steve.
Yeah, they, you know, maybe a bit more advertising with, you know, or bigger pictures of the helmet's color schemes when they're, you know, introducing them at the start of the race.
Well, you know, I have to admit, I mean, I remember Fernando Alonso's few numbers, number 8, number 5. But
because you have baseball caps with that number pasted on the side of them.
Yes, but to be honest with you, I just use the, you know, his name. People know which team he's on, or Schumacher, or who else. I think the idea is good, but I think Jean Todt, it's just not going to work for Formula One.
No, I would be really tough for them to implement, and I don't think it would have the same. I don't think it would necessarily have the effect that Jean Todt wants.
Well, he admits that he needs a majority of the teams to agree with his new plans, but so far, many teams have disagreed to commit to his concept. So there you go, Jean Todt. You know, feeling out the teams and trying to come up with some new ideas. But anyway. Australia.
And I like the way that he does that, unlike some previous leaders of the FAI who went, hey, we're going to do this.
I agree. No, he's not dictatorial. But anyway, it's going to be a great race. I can't wait for Australia. I'm predicting excitement. Pirelli, Renault doing well. Of course, Red Bull will do well, but they're still with Renault, so that makes me feel good inside. So, there you have it. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. We've got an outstanding Motorsports Mondial. And of course, stay tuned for the repeat interview with Mario Andretti. We'll be back after this brief message.
Hi, I'm Clark Rogers, host of F1Weekly.com's podcast. Please visit our website, F1Weekly.com, your fresh new destination for all your Formula One needs. F1Weekly.com brings you a weekly podcast that covers the latest news, rumors, and insightful commentary related to the pinnacle of modern motorsports, Formula One. You can find us on iTunes and other popular podcast locations. F1Weekly.com. Thank you.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the Swami, Nasser Hamid.
Greetings and racing regards. What is this world coming to, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen? A delayed F1 season was not bad enough, but this week we can't even cover a cup race. The NASCAR nation has taken a weekend off. Amazing, but true. Were you able to get some sleep on Sunday night?
Absolutely. Greg Biffle is on the golf course, so I was able to sleep well.
That's good. So Cher and Autosport magazine have come to the rescue. Today, we shall look at some of the events that rocked Formula One, as reported in the March 3rd issue of this very fine magazine. From cheating and grand theft, all the way to gunfight at the Racing Corral. It's amazing what has gone on with Formula One and motorsports associated people. But let's look at some racing news since our last podcast. There has been some developments.
There's always developments in this industry.
Yes, and we will go very south of the border all the way to Argentina for the Argentine Touring Cars. The series is called TC, I think TC stands for Turismo Carreteras, you know, something like
Machismo.
That. Yeah, 2000. They had their opening race of the season at General Roca Park City and was won by Juan Manuel Silva, not Fangio, in a Ford. Among the drivers in the series are Norberto Fontana, who raced in Formula One briefly and is a past winner of the prestigious Masters of F3 at Sanford, and Peter Windsor and Ken Anderson's lost pal in the Pampas, Jose Maria Lopez, a.k.a. Pachito. Pachito is... he's looking for Peter Windsor to come to Buenos Aires. I think he has an arrest warrant out for him upon arrival. The series website is www.tc2000.com.ar, here for Argentina, and they have some nice videos of races from past seasons. And you know, these past few days and weeks where we all are missing the Bahrain Grand Prix, I've been going to this and stopandgo.tv, getting my fix of motorsports, karting. So this is a pretty good website, nice videos, a lot of nice tracks down there and lots of fun. Round two is next month in the streets of Santa Fe, not New Mexico, Santa Fe, Argentina, the hometown of Senor and Governor Carlos Reutemann. Next, World Series by Renault, your favorite series.
I love this series.
Gee, I wonder why. Preseason testing taking place this week at Barcelona. You know, today I got a request on a LinkedIn from a racing driver, and this is what he wrote. Since I trust you, I would like to invite you to my LinkedIn circle.
Wow, that's a tight circle. LinkedIn is tight.
Yeah, and people start trusting you, you know, it gets scary.
I mean, I don't even think we're friends on LinkedIn.
I don't think so. Yeah. Are we even on Facebook?
Yeah, we are on Facebook. Yeah? Because okay, that's a nice and casual, but LinkedIn is for professionals.
Yeah, well, who can reach up to your professional
exactly
height? So I won't even try, Mr. Rogers. Anyway, World Series by Renault preseason testing taking place this week at Barcelona. Daniel Ricciardo looking more and more as the main man this season as the champion. But they have to run their races. I thought he was going to win last year, and so did he. But on the closing laps of the final race, he got the Russian shaft from, you know, Mikhail Aleshin. Ricciardo is from Perth, Western Australia. He has been the pace setter, rain or shine, and just like the previous test session, I mean, the guy is doing very, very well, and let's see what happens. I'm looking forward to having a chat with him over some Victoria Bitter, not Foster's, in Spain. Also going very quick, no surprises, your homeboy Jean-Éric Wynne of Francia and Robert Wickens from north of the border, as in Toronto, O Canada. Alexander Rossi from Northern Cali has also been competitive. And Rossi is first year this season, and Ricciardo is second, so you know, experience will count for a little bit. It should be a great season. All these support series have great talents this year. Remember some years ago, Flavio and even John Dennis made a comment that the crop in GP2 is not good.
I remember that.
I believe it was the year Timo Glock won the championship.
Correct.
But this year, there is some serious crop in GP2, World Series by Renault, Formula Renault Euro Cup, British F3. It's going to be dog-eat-dog all the way.
All the way to Formula One.
All the way to Formula One. There will be some casualties.
Excellent.
Yes. And we're not going to predict who the casualties or the winners will be.
We just predict the news.
Exactly. Yes, and we will see what happens. Now we come to F3 Euro Series. They were testing at Valencia this week. Excuse me, more. Laurence Venthoor of Belgium was the fastest on day one for Signature Team, who are running on Volkswagen Power. And Signature is the team that took Eduardo Mortara to a runaway championship
last year.
Thank you, sir. Day two saw a change of power with local driver Roberto Meri fastest in a Mercedes Power Prema Team car. And Prema Team is from Italy, and Signature, I believe, is from Francia, if I'm not mistaken. Kimi Sato was second fastest, and we are checking. You know, we have a very elaborate, in-depth fact-checking verification process. So we are trying to see if Kimi Sato is any relation to Taku-san. But, you know, like you said, we also predict news, we also predict results of investigation. In this case, probably he is not related to Taku, because rumors are saying that his car stays on the track during the whole race.
Let's hope Sato's not listening.
Yeah, we should be kind to him. He did give us a plug.
He did give us a plug.
But he's a grown boy. He can take a, you know, a little side of wasabi.
Of course.
IndyCar testing at Barber Motorsports Park near Birmingham, Sweet Home Alabama. And this song was playing on the radio as I was driving to.
And this is one of your favorite songs.
Absolutely. But, you know, when they talk about Southland, I think of L.A., not, you know,
Orange County.
Exactly. Santa Monica Boulevard and Newport Beach. Okay, what happened there is Penske drivers stayed on top on the opening days. Will Power set the pace on the first day. He's, of course, from Australia. And Elio Castro Nordash Neves from Brazil was the quickest on day two. As has been the case for the last so many years, it will be Penske versus Ganassi.
Of course. How do you think Bourdais is going to come out?
He's not with the top team, so, and plus he will miss some races because of his commitment with Peugeot. He'll be all right. I mean, when he was winning, you know, winning is always good. He was with the top team, and he was really gelled into that program, but this might take some effort, and there is some very good talent. At that time, it was a split series, but still he did a great job. Can't take that away from him. But those glory days are gone.
I agree, and I think Powers is going to be a tough cookie to beat.
Yeah, Powers is good. And do you think he thinks too much about his Toro Rosso days?
No, I don't.
I think he's just grateful that he had the opportunity to race in Formula One.
Yeah, it, you know, how many people can say that?
Because, you know, when we talked to him when he was still in
with
Champs Cars. Yeah, Newman Husband, Champs Car. He didn't think he was ever going to get there.
No, he started cussing, actually.
Yeah, he pretty much decided that he was not going to get to Formula One.
What did he say? Stupid, well, I'm not going to go to Formula One.
Stupid! Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's the thing is, you know, I was thinking about him the other day. I was reading, you know, what he's doing. And I thought, you know, if you are winning so many championships here, I mean, you have to try Formula One. But you have to know going in that Toro Rosso, how far will you go? But then again, it's the other...
Excuse me?
Look at Sebastian Vettel.
So yes.
I mean, you know, Nanda came through Minardi and Schumacher came through what? One race through Jordan. Boy, that's the way it goes. MotoGP news, Japanese Grand Prix set for next month will now take place in October, and I don't think I need to explain why. And Steve has a finger going, and what is he saying?
Firestone.
Firestone. Oh, Tarfar. We have a Tarfar.
We have a Tarfar.
We have a Tar.
It's a flashing.
Thank you, Mr. Fob. Okay, let me go back to IndyCars. Firestone makes a U-turn and will stay in IndyCar racing for a few more years, which is good for the series. They have a nice momentum going, but see, here is a little cut in the tire. And so will Tony George. He has been voted back on the board of directors of Hulman & Company, the parent company of Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And let's see how this Speedway soap opera plays out later this season. Apparently, the people who have voted him back are his cronies.
Yeah, but okay. What about the sisters?
Yeah, but that only puts him back on the board of the Speedway. It doesn't put him back in any way with the IRL, does it?
No, but see, he's on the board with his cronies, and if the majority of them are on your side, then you will get your wish. And that's what people are concerned about. The new man, Randy Bernard, has created quite a good PR for the series and has come up with some creative ideas like this $5 million if somebody wins the last race who is not from IndyCars.
And some interesting possible entries for that $5 million purse.
Yeah, it's a big purse. And, you know, so he's doing what he can. But the last thing we need is for him to seek express written consent from TG. And there is more on this on Speed TV. Robin Miller has a column, Miller's Mailbag, it is called. A lot of people have expressed their opinion, and it's interesting to see how one-sided the whole thing is. Obviously, people are concerned about Tony George coming back to the hen house. Okay, now we move to MotoGP. Japanese Grand Prix, like I said, has been moved to October and was set for next month, and I don't think I need to explain the reason behind this. If you are awake, any part of the last 2 weeks. You know what I'm saying?
I understand that, sir.
In final preseason testing at Losail Track in Qatar, our favorite place, Casey Stoner was the fastest rider ahead of his Honda teammate, Danny Pedrosa. Man, Danny Pedrosa is one kid. His parade has been rained on by this guy, Jorge Lorenzo, and all previously by Casey Stoner. At one time, he was looking to be the next young Spanish world champion. Then came, you know, Stoner rained on his parade with his Ducati, and then Jorge Lorenzo. Ben Spies from Texas was third quickest on his Yamaha. Nicky Hayden was ninth for Ducati. And interestingly, Honda has been the fastest bike in all 8 test sessions during the winter. So it's looking good for Casey Stoner even after leaving Ducati. Driver signings. Marcus Winkelhock, who lost his Audi ride in DTM, will now move up to a Lamborghini in the FIA GT1 championship. So he's bullish on the 2011 season. From one German driver to another, Marco Wittmann, once a client of Willy Weber, will stay with Signature Team for another season of F3 Euro Series. So good for him. There's a lot of ladies coming in motor racing.
I like that.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And they all have racing in their eyes.
Exactly.
Yes. Giada De Zen, she is 15 years old and will race this season in Formula Renault Alps, which resulted from the merger of Swiss and Italian Formula Renault championships. And talking of girl power, Shannon McIntosh, a young lady, I think she's from Michigan but now hanging out in Florida, will take part in this year's U.S. Formula 2000 championship, which starts this week as support race to the Sebring 12 Hours. In testing this week, Petri Suvanto from Finlandia and a friend of F1 Weekly and local American driver Zach Veach were the pace setters, and I've been chatting with Petri Suvanto quite a bit. Unfortunately, they don't have a race on the West Coast, so maybe I'll go to the Baltimore race and take my kids, nephews there and hook up with them. And let's see how all things happen. So we wish everybody all the best. Okay, motorsport this weekend. In America, we have Sebring 12 Hours, as I mentioned, and support race, of course, U.S. Formula 2000. In Italy, we have the second and final round of the GP2 Asia Championship at Imola. And for those who missed out all the fun in Bahrain, last I checked, Imola is not in Asia.
It's not.
This was to be in Bahrain, but they had other agenda. So it will be interesting to see how this season develops between Romain Grosjean and Jules Bianchi. I think that's a serious junkyard dogfight.
You mean some cage rattling?
Serious cage rattling, French cage rattling. And these people need to be careful, because if they take out each other in a couple of races, because both are very competitive, then the third man may win the championship. And I say the best man win the championship. We'll see what that will be. In the gas-rich Qatar country nation, we have the season opener of MotoGP under the Arabian Night and GE lights. Imagination at work. Are you going to watch a little bit of GE? The MotoGP this year?
Absolutely.
GE would be a good sponsor for GE MotoGP.
I think GE would be a great sponsor for F1 Weekly. GE F1 Weekly.
Mm-hmm. We will even take Osram bulbs.
Absolutely.
To keep the light on. How about Motel 6 as a sponsor?
Any sponsor. We're going down fast here.
We're going down towards the checkered flag. But we're not going out of business, you know
no
that.
No way. No, are you kidding?
Have we ever missed a show since we all started doing this together?
No, we haven't.
Christmas, New Year's Day, Independence Day.
We work around the clock. We have a full staff that's constantly checking all your facts, dotting the I's, crossing the T's.
I'm out of town, show goes on. You're out of town, show goes on. Mr. Fab goes to Colorado, Seattle, wherever, Czech Republic, show goes on. Okay, so now we come to, thanks to Mr. Peter Brazier, Autosport had a story on events that rock Formula One. Very, very interesting, and most of them were in our lifetime, or at least the lifetime we've been following Formula One. So it was nice to get a, you know, flashback to those events. Not surprisingly, it starts with driver wars, and the mother of all battles was the rivalry between Senna and Prost. It became pretty vicious.
It was pretty ugly.
Yes. And, you know, it all started from San Marino Grand Prix. You know, what happened at that San Marino Grand Prix between him and Prost? It's one of those things, you have to get Jacoby and Myers and F. Lee Bailey on this. The agreement between the two was that whoever gets to the first corner will, you know, take the lead at that time. They won't fight.
This is folklore now in Formula One.
And then you know what happened at the start. There was a yellow flag, or the race was stopped, and the first time it happened, you know, Prost was ahead, so Senna didn't try to pass him. But then the race was stopped, and the second time it started, he passed him. And then his thing was, you know, the agreement was, at the start, this was the second start. So it's, you know, it really depends what side of the fence you are, but these things happen, boys will be boys, and we move on.
Was an exciting season, though.
You better believe it, sir. And the ending was very good, too. Okay, highlight of this rivalry was Prost take, or highlights, I should say, was Prost taking out Senna in 1989 and Senna returning the favor in 1990, both happening at Suzuka with the championship-winning result, with championship-winning results for each driver. And that was amazing, unbelievable, as it was happening. There is also mention of, as they call it, one of the most acrimonious finishes to a race, the Villeneuve and Pironi fallout at Imola in 1982. And boy, do I remember that very well.
And you've talked about this.
We've talked about, this is like one of the major stories of motor racing. You know, it's just like Jackie Stewart winning the German Grand Prix in the rain by a wide margin. The great thing about reading all this was, I said, man, I was at this historic event, which is coming up. Right here in the U.S. Do you remember the year?
Exciting.
Yes. The 2007 Hungarian Grand Prix. Oh, boy. Last minute collie. Another one for the ages.
I can't believe this one came up.
How can it not come up?
That's your favorite, isn't it?
No, it just... it's nothing like discussing your tire strategy with your physio.
It's my favorite. I love this. I think this strategy should be used more often.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and then, you know, it's just be careful what you wish for.
I just will never forget Ron Dennis's face when he went to the physio, took his headset off. I mean, it was just great, great drama.
Oh, no, absolutely it was. And you normally don't see Ron Dennis like that.
No.
And then, you know, as far as this thing is concerned, again, easy to say after the fact, Alonso, in a worst-case situation, was going to be second on the grid. And those points would have given him three in a row. And it's just like...
I know. Yeah. It's amazing. It's unbelievable, but still, it was exciting. It was captivating. Yeah. I mean, it was great stuff.
Yeah, where every half a second counts. a guy is just sitting there for 10 seconds after his car has been.
God, I'll never forget. That was a great moment.
Oh, yeah, that was a great. I'm sure it was.
Thanks, Fernando.
Yes. Next, your services are no longer required. Heading the list in this department is Alain Prost, who was fired by Ferrari before the final race of the season for comparing his F1 car to a truck. He should have known no such thing as a sweet 16 semi. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to, I mean, as passionate as the Italians are about the motor racing, you don't call a Ferrari Formula One car, my car is a truck. That's what he
did. Unless, of course, you've named it an F-150.
That, you know, maybe that's how Luca got the idea.
Cyclone Blue.
Yeah.
Preview. Another reason that we've been talking about guys talking down their teams or their cars before races, there's another reason not to be doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's wonderful.
Another French driver was also shown the door by Ferrari, his old friend from Renault days, René Arnoux, who was let go after the 1985 Brazilian Grand Prix in mysterious circumstances. And this magazine, Autosport, says for his rock and roll style. Somebody told me many years ago that it was drug related. He was on using drugs or whatever. I don't know if this is true. And obviously when I ran into René Arnoux a couple of years ago at Le Mans, it was in the, you know, this restaurant at the trackside. His daughter was there, and I don't think it was the right moment to talk to him.
You did the right thing.
To ask that particular question.
Yeah, exactly. And René Arnoux, you know what he did at one time? I believe the team was Ligier, and they were at a track in Italy. They could have been at Alfa Romeo's track, Balocco, near Milan, and they were evaluating Alfa Romeo engines, trying to get their deal, engine deal. And René Arnoux made a comment to the press at the track that, yeah, they were evaluating their engines and there are some Renault engine, Alfa Romeo engineers here, but I'm not sure of their qualifications. Or I have some doubts to their qualification. Oh, the deal was canceled immediately. They were not too happy. Everybody, and the guy speaks very good Italian.
Oh, yeah, but everybody's so sensitive.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's like this. Next time you get your pay raise and you tell your boss, you know, boss, your wife is really ugly. Let's see how far that goes. And things happen, man. Bizarre things have happened in motor racing, and we shall talk more on these issues some other time. Okay, next topic covered by Autosport magazine is cheating.
Cheating.
Cheating. Can you believe that?
Shocking.
Yes. Schumacher dominates this category, courtesy of shenanigans at Jerez in 1997 and Monaco 2006. For me, as just as a racing fan, which is what I am, and a highly paid podcaster, thanks to you, Jerez was a heat of the moment, championship at stake deal. I can think of a few champions, world champions, who would have done or have done similar things. We just talked about two already. But Monaco 2006 was totally beyond any excuse. The greatest driver of his generation, maybe of all time, cannot park his car on the slowest corner of the slowest track on the circuit. And it just looks so hokey. What say you?
It was beautiful. Valet parking in Formula One. It was great.
He was hungry. He wanted to get a sandwich.
It was another great moment that we'll never forget.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's always, and forever will live, the Roscos moment.
Yeah, it's just great stuff. And I'm glad we're just alive to see some of this.
Yeah,
stuff.
You know, even I remember Danny Sullivan was doing the commentary
for ABC.
ABC, whoever was calling, CBS. And he said that Schumacher thought he was smart, but Stewart deemed that he was too smart. And then Keke Rosberg was very pissed off. He says, you know, if you have to do something like this to win, go and do something else. And despite all this kind of condemnation, what does Schumacher say? A typical Schumacher style, that instead of saying I made a mistake, or, you know, he could have come up, he just comes out on his truck when he was asked by media again and again, oh, those who know me know I'm not like that. And I'm like thinking, geez, yeah, I have not forgotten Adelaide 1994, now the Jerez thing. But, you know, we all make mistakes.
Exactly.
Yeah. And now when I read this headline today on a different website, I mean, I felt bad for him. It says, we are aiming for podium finishes.
I know, that's pretty sad, but
yeah,
it's true.
For him, it's sad, you
He's
know.
He's excited.
Yeah, well, I hope they have a competitive car. And if
I think Mercedes GP will look good this year.
Yeah, and if he wins, it will be very good for motor racing. For
It'll be good
one.
For Germany, too.
Yeah. Well, they only got maybe Schumi going.
I know.
Okay, now we go to cheating. We're still on cheating. Bar Honda. This was another great moment, and I'll never forget the explanation by Nick Fry. Nick Fry is the name, right? When sitting in front of a FIA tribunal, I would knowingly never allow something like that. Man, you cannot change a small thing on a car, and they have a separate fuel tank or whatever, and you don't know this?
That was big.
Yeah. Anyway, Bar Honda gets a mention for running underweight in 2005 San Marino Grand Prix, and they were thrown out for two races, if I remember.
Correct. Yeah, because they didn't compete in Monaco in the race after that year.
Yeah, and Team Tyrrell did a similar trick in 1984, and their results were purged from history, as Autosport calls it. And Schumacher's points were also taken in when he ran into Jacques Villeneuve. Okay. Now we come to people who were on the Bobby Fuller program and fought the law.
And I fought the law, and the law won.
Exactly. And leading this category is, and I asked his driver, Yannick Dalmas. He was very surprised that I would even ask him and kind of avoided the issue. Didier Calmel. This French businessman was partnered in the Larousse Calmel Formula One team in 1987. In 1989, he shot and killed his wife, apparently over having an affair with another man. I thought that was a privilege in a French marriage. You always mention things like that.
That's true.
Yeah, so these things happen. Yeah, another of your homeboys, Gerard Thot, T-O-T-H. Another French fiasco. After taking charge of Renault Sport in 1985, he went to jail for taking a cut over an engine deal with Ken Tyrrell's team.
He got caught. This happens all the time.
That is very true. That I agree. This happens all the time at the top level, and when you get caught, you blame the devil or, you know, whoever. NASCAR.
Just like Nixon.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. This is a strange, and people who are interested in this story, they can do some Google search, and this is a very amazing story. We have the bizarre case of Klaus Rath, who was known as Rainer Waldorf. He bought into the Larousse Venturini team in 1992, but the police wanted to question him relating to several murders. From what I remember, reading a story about a year or two ago, the French police went to his house where he threatened the officer with a grenade, and he basically tied both of them up, took off in their car, and was AWOL, and this happened in France, of course. He was later tracked down to a hideout, which I believe was in Germany, and he was killed in a gunfire with the Polizei.
Very bizarre.
Yeah, very bizarre. And now we come to F1 fisticuffs. Fights, you know. Let's get physical.
Like Tagliani and all your friends.
Yeah, Tracy. And, okay, this includes Senna punching Irvine at Suzuka, Schumacher going for DC's jugular at Spa, and the all-time favorite Thai boxing match at Hockenheim 1982 between Nelson Piquet and Elisio Salazar. And you were at that Belgian Grand Prix, right?
Spa, 98.
Yeah, interesting. I remember watching that race, and here comes, you know, out of nowhere, and Schumacher bang into the back of DC. It was just like Senna crashing into the back of... It's amazing how the very greats make the same mistakes, same type of mistakes, and not just mistakes and other kinky stuff that gets them in heat, and then they try to be, you know, hey, you know what? I thought there was room. But anyway, boys will be boys. Okay, other issues covered are race fixing in the 1933 Tripoli Grand Prix, which is another famous story, the tire fiasco at Indy in 2005, and our favorite, the spying and texting case of Arrows versus Shadow and McLaren, respectively. Now, do you remember the texting and the powder?
I don't think there was any texting at Arrows and Shadows.
No. That was the spying.
It was probably telegrams or something.
It says, respectively, spying and texting case of Arrows versus Shadow and McLaren, respectively.
But the cars did look similar at the Arrows and the Shadows.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why they were sued.
No, absolutely. But yeah.
And you know the interesting thing about that whole lawsuit was the Shadow was designed by Tony Southgate, and so was the Arrow. Okay, his crime was, had he gone and designed everything the same, he probably would have gotten away with it. But they got shafted because they took the drawings That was their big crime.
He took the prints. He didn't go and make copies.
Prints, yeah. He didn't make the copies. It would give him credit for that. So there you have it, sir. Okay. Finally, we started with the Gypsy theme, and we closed the show with a Curtis Mayfield classic, Gypsy Woman.
Before I knew the night was through, and I was all alone. The charms of the gypsy woman and a caravan was gone. All was left were burning embers of a love that made my heart surrender to a gypsy woman. She was a gypsy woman.
Thanks, Nas, for another outstanding Motorsports Mondial. Stay tuned for Mario Andretti.
Welcome to F1 Weekly. And today's show, we're going to do an interview with racing legend Mario Andretti. And now, for a few moments from Laguna Seca.
Yeah, you know, it's what happened on, I think, Friday night, or very late in the week, I found out. I think it was Mr. Rogers sent me an email that Mario Andretti was going to be in a sort of a press
meeting, conference,
yeah, you know, for media people between 9:45 to 10:30. So I scooted over there, you know. I've admired the guy for a long time, tremendous
person. Oh, yeah.
So anyway, I go there and I was in this press conference. Unfortunately, my goal was to record the whole, but the way it was set up, the people who were asking questions did not have a microphone, so it was not going to work out, and I didn't want to create any scene there. So anyway, he talked about a lot of things. You know, people were asking him. I asked him a few questions also. And highlight of the day for me was definitely to see Mario Andretti drive his 1978 World Championship winning Lotus 79. In that beautiful black and gold JPS colors, and Mr. Rogers taking a lot of photographs. He put one on the webpage also. And this car makes a beautiful sound, and Mario looked like a Mario in that car. And I made a comment to him, man, I mean, you went out of the pit. He went out of the pit like he was in a race, like Schumacher was going to pass him just now.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy, he's a born racer, you know. It was very
no such thing as slow.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just a beautiful car. The car is 30 years old, still looks like a fairly decent competitive car.
Yeah.
Beautiful noise, and to see that helmet and all that, just very good. And I, you know, remember when I was talking to Mansell, I asked him, Mario Andretti had called him his worst teammate. So I asked Mario, you know, if he could explain a little bit on that. And he basically said that, you know, with Ronnie Peterson, you could sit down and talk, or with other teammates, you know, plan a strategy, help each other out, you know, develop the car or sort out the car. And he said with Mansell, the way he was saying was interesting. He said he came and he just grabbed all the best engineer, best all the technicians, and there was no need to do this. And he said we never had a meeting with him. So basically what he was saying is that there was no, you know, that he never had that team spirit.
No esprit de corps. He basically was in it for himself.
Yeah. And he said when he had a great season, everything was happy. You know, he was very happy, but when things did not go his way in the second year, he started criticizing the same people. And then, you know, Mario, he said something very interesting. He was talking about, somebody asked him about Marco going to Formula One. And the thing about, you know, when I also had an opportunity to do a one-on-one interview with Mario Andretti for 10 minutes, which I was looking forward to for many years, I'll tell you, and I say this as all respect to him, I was feeling like a 15-year-old kid, and I got the impression, the passion he had, the way he was answering a question, like I was talking to another 15-year-old kid, the two 15-year-olds have just seen their first Formula One race, race. I mean, and that's what I like about when I deal with people who have love for motor racing, you know, whether it's 3-time world champion or a kid in tennis in Seattle or, you know, anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just the passion people have, which I enjoy very much. But anyway, going back to Marco, he said something that I had always believed in, and coming from him, he should know, and I'm not convinced that I was on the right track. He said, you know, you cannot teach someone to go faster. He said, you can hone their skills, and with the experience, you become a better driver. And I've always had that belief that once you sit into a car, first time in your life, you bring whatever fancy word you want to use, talent, God-given talent, or, you know,
package. Spatial ability.
Yeah, and if you're on a scale of one, like, you know, basically my thing was that Ralph, you can go to any school and Rob Wilson or whatever, Racing Academy, Jim Russell. A Ralph Schumacher will never be a Michael Schumacher. You cannot train Fisichella to be a Fangio or a Massa to be a Moss.
No, ultimately, everybody's talent peaks out at a certain point.
Yeah.
You know, all the guys in Formula One have the ability to win races and championships if they're in the right package. But some guys are just faster.
Yeah.
They just have the ability to push that car as far as it will go without taking it off the track.
Yeah. And then, you know, some gentleman asked him, of all the races, he has won in everything.
Yeah.
He said, of all the races you have won, what is the most important victory for you? And he said that the most important win for him was his victory in 1978 Italian Grand Prix at Monza, which gave him the championship. And this is a race where his teammate Ronnie Peterson was killed. But unfortunately, victory was snatched from him for jumping the start along with Gilles Villeneuve. They both were given a one-minute penalty. So Mario Andretti took the win, but with a one-minute penalty, he dropped back to sixth, and Niki Lauda got the win. And then I asked him for his thoughts on Colin Chapman and Enzo Ferrari, two of the people he drove for, and it just was interesting. You know, he says with Colin Chapman, I'm saying this because this is not in the interview that I did one-on-one, so I'd like to share what he said with listeners. He said with Colin Chapman and Enzo Ferrari, it was one thing. These people demanded performance now. That was all. They were not looking for any excuses. I can't find the brake pedal or what is, you know, the tires.
I'm not getting to grips with this car kind of thing.
Yeah, they had no room for it. I mean, they demanded performance and now. And he said with Colin Chapman, he said, I always knew that if you get on his side when he was on the uptake, then, you know, sky was the limit. That, you know, once his whatever package he or, you know, technology he was trying to embrace and incorporate into his car, if it worked out, then nobody's going to catch you.
Right.
And that's what happened in 78. But the things they tried in 79, he could not even get into it. It was a hard time getting into the top five. So it was very nice to hear from the man, you know. And then somebody asked him, when you went to Monza and put the car on pole in 1982, that was my first race that I went to, he said, how did that deal come about? Who called you? And he says, you know, Mr. Ferrari called me himself. Can you imagine? A racing driver cannot get a better compliment than Enzo Ferrari calling you.
Exactly.
Would you like to drive my car?
Exactly.
Yeah, and just to hear it from the man himself, it's just like a very incredible. And I told Mario, man, hey, I was there as a young kid. I'm 23 years old, and living in beautiful Karachi in those days. And I will never forget. I mean, I knew his history then also, that he was born in Italy for all practical purposes. He's an Italian man, then he came here. And for me to be there, you know, and this on Saturday, the commentator, there used to be an English guy, I think his name was Anthony Marsh, I believe was the name, with that very heavy voice. Like, you know, same guy now goes to all the races, Bob Constanduras, and he had a very heavy voice. And, of course, the Italian announcer, when they were saying that on pole position, Mario Andretti of the United States. I mean, it was just unbelievable chills I had. I mean, just, you know, it's just what it took for him, you know, to come here, to do what he did here, went through, you know, whatever he had to go through, and to go back there, win the championship, come back to the U.S., and then get a phone call, hey, come and drive my car.
Yeah.
And then put the car on pole position. Like, man, I mean, I have chills right now, as you can see. That was just a fabulous, fabulous conversation. And I met his PR assistant also. And, you know, it's hard to get 20 minutes from people like him. So, and by the way, if I may share a personal thing, before I came to the U.S., I used to write to a lot of racing people in this country. And there were two or three people who corresponded with me on fairly regular basis. Mario Andretti was one of them. So I have a connection with him going back 20 plus years. And the thing I really want to see is the trophy he got for winning the Italian Grand Prix in 77 and what he got for getting the pole. Because, you know, like you said, Monza is my favorite track. It's also my favorite track. So what I'm trying to do now is I'm not going to bug him at every race, but maybe every 3-4 months if I'm at a race, I'll ask his assistant if I can get 5-6 minutes. And every time, get in like 5-8 questions, and then after 3-4, you know, we'll have a 1-hour
one-hour interview
session.
In, 8 increments.
Yeah, I'll tell you, man, I mean, you talk about a man with a passion for motor racing and all those achievements. And now, you know, we're going to play that interview, and Mr. David Tapia, our illustrious producer, was asking me to write an intro for Mario. I mean, the intro for Mario is the name, Mario Andretti.
Well, yeah, but knowing that, but to list his accomplishments is a complete segment for motorsports memories.
Yeah, you know, he was IndyCar champion in his rookie year. I mean, the guy has won Daytona 500, Sebring, and just like about anything. And, of course, any of his competitors, when you talk to them, probably if you ask AJ or Bobby Unser or anybody who was the toughest hombre, this is one of the if it's not the first name, it's definitely the second name. And all those people in Formula One who race against him, that name comes up. Yeah. I mean, you know, the name has been used in songs a few times. So it's just, I was very, very happy to be able to sit down and talk to him face to face.
So let's do that interview right now.
Grazie.
Okay, Mario, 30 years ago you won the world championship. Today you're driving that car. What kind of memories came racing back?
Oh, all of the good memories that I have with it. Every time I sit in a cockpit, it's the third time now in the last few years in this car. It just, you know, it's my element, and it's easy to sort of start, you know, just enjoying what I've enjoyed in the past. And it's a great opportunity, especially right here at Laguna Seca. You know, this is one great venue for me, you know, with wonderful memories besides, and a great racetrack. You know, this is actually the first time that I drove a Formula One. I can say I drove a Formula One car around Laguna Seca as well.
In 1977, you won two important Formula One races, one at Monza, land of your birth, and the other in Long Beach, land that gave you comfort, fame, and fortune. And in both races, Ferrari was second, Niki Lauda. Which race meant more to you? Which victory meant more to you at the time?
Well, at the time, each one was equally important. However, when I reflect back now, I think from a standpoint of just my own private pride and overall feeling of fulfillment, it was Monza, you know, because that's where I saw my very first Formula One race when I was very young, and that's probably one of the races that cemented my decision to just pursue this career.
Is there anything you remember from that race?
I remember just about everything, and all I know is that I was rooting for my idol Alberto Ascari, who had a very tough day against the Mercedes of Fangio and Moss, but he showed so much heart, and actually I was so excited because I knew that he was an inferior car, yet he was still driving 103%, and that was something to watch.
Well, that's the heart and passion. I remember you from your days in Formula One. Marco, in Formula One, there's a lot of talk, a lot of hope. Would you recommend for him or any young aspiring American driver to do a season of two in GP2 or Formula 3 before getting into the Piranha pool, that is Formula Uno?
Well, you know, I don't think there's a set formula, you know. Number one, right now, Marco is in a maximum formula here. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, well, you know, it's not a good training for Formula One. Except that once you have a feel for powerful racing cars and so on and so forth and the top competition, if you go to another discipline, like, say, Formula One, and the team really embraces you, and they give you the opportunity to really, before the season, the following season starts, to really get familiar and confident in the car. It would be better to have a season and know the circuits. But you know something? That is not necessary and totally, the thing that's required. Because historically, you have, look at Hamilton, for instance. You know, he's never been to, last year he was never at Montreal. First time ever, and you cannot test in Montreal. So he first saw the circuit, you know, through a video game probably first, and then through the eyes of a racing car when it was time to go official practice. He won the race. Why? Because he had the full confidence of the car, and any good racing driver will learn the circuit quickly. And so, again, yeah, but I think he's at the stage that he could go directly to a team and just start just the real thing.
Will he listen to you or Papa when it comes to going to Formula One?
Well, I think he better listen to me when it comes to Formula One, I think. And I think he probably does. I mean, he has his own way of expressing himself, and it should be. But at the same time, I think deep down, he for sure has this as the ultimate goal in his career. And now it's all about having the opportunity. You know, he has to put together some really good results and really continue to impress, you know, before somebody would be interested, you know, in looking at him for Formula One.
Your last season, full season in Formula One, was with Alfa Romeo, a magical name in motor racing. That's where Signor Ferrari started. Did you work with Carlo Chitti, and how was that experience?
Well, I did work, of course. Carlo Chitti was the chief engineer and team manager and everything. And you know, I had driven sports prototypes for them as well. The biggest problem that I encountered in the 1980 season was that they didn't really read the rules properly, you know, and it was very gray area. And everybody was somewhat cheating, you know, with the hydraulic systems, you know, and, you know, you had a box that you had to clear on the way out of the pits. But then all of a sudden you released the hydraulics and the car dropped 4 inches in ride height, you know. So, Alfa Romeo thought that that was cheating, so they didn't want to do it. But we suffered tremendously because the car, I think, was capable of really being very competitive. And because of that, it was a very frustrating year for me, and one of the years in my career that I certainly want to forget.
In Formula One, what is your favorite track apart from Monza Autodromo?
Well, I had many tracks that I just loved tremendously. I mean, Kyalami was a good track for me. You know, the ones that I really enjoyed, but it's wherever I could win. You know, I had a policy with me that I would never say this is favorite, this is not, because then your mindset would be wrong. To me, I treated them all as my favorite, but obviously, the memories of a win are always the positive memories, and those are the ones that I consider, you know, the ones that I enjoy the most.
You raced in Formula One against some of the greatest names in the sport, making your debut on pole position in 1968. Give me the two toughest drivers you raced against in Formula One, please.
I don't think I could really single it out to just two toughest drivers. Each era has the individual that's a yardstick, and I remember for me it was very, very meaningful when I did my very first, stint in Formula One, even part-time in 68, when I put the car on pole and Jackie Stewart finished second. And he was the man in those days. And then when I won my very first Formula One race in South Africa, Jackie Stewart was second. And then I won the next non-championship race in Ontario. There were two 100-mile races. I won both, and Jackie Stewart was second in both times. And that told me something, gave me a lot of confidence that, you know what, this day I beat the best. And so I think I have a future here, you know, with a proper team, proper equipment. And it was very important. And other times in the United States it was A.J. Foyt, and there was the answers. In Formula One, again, I can look back. It could be James Hunt, could be Niki Lauda, could be many individuals that I even don't come to mind at the moment. Like you said, I was fortunate enough to race with the very best of the different eras, and that is something that I treasure.
Talking of James Hunt, do you remember what happened at Dutch Grand Prix 1977?
I remember that very well. In fact, that's he and I had a big disagreement over that, because I think I made a good pass on him on the outside, and he never expected me to do that, because that's not usually the way the passes are done in Formula One, and he ran right over my wheels. He just totally ignored the fact that I was there, and then he says I wasn't supposed to be there. I said, well, I think you got it wrong, my friend. You know, as long as the tarmac, you know, somebody's going to be there, and you have to respect that. And we had a disagreement over that, of course.
Finally, how about a message to listeners of F1 Weekly? We have a worldwide audience, and I'm sure everybody would love to hear from you.
Well, you know, Formula One is my ultimate love. It always will be. And you know, it's wonderful. To me, it's heartwarming to see so many fans that follow Formula One. And I think the experts, so-called experts, do underestimate how much love, how much of a following there is in Formula One in the United States. And I'd just love to see that increase by having an American to root for. And I hope our boy Marco is the one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mario, for speaking with F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we go to the wrap-up, we've got the forum updates.
This week's forum updates from Koala. After a few quiet weeks, as the Australian Grand Prix gets closer, the forum has ramped up its activity. Topics and discussions have been diverse but interesting. The thread commenced by Yay Tennis receives a 6-month driving ban summed up the off-season nature of threads in the forum. Yay reported that Ron Dennis had lost his license after failing to stop at a red light. Forum members did not express much sympathy for the poor old Ron, but did commence a discussion on the relative point losses of various forum members, some of which should be ashamed. Then, in typical off-season meandering, the thread morphed into a discussion on the fuel prices various forum members were paying, and then, after the startling revelation that our Lexus-loving Yay was yearning for a Fiat 500, commenced discussing the merits of electric cars and bicyclists. But it is F1 topics with the season open so close that have dominated the forum this week. Some of the topics forum members contemplated were, is Sutil the most boring driver ever? HRT does have a car. The confirmation that Liuzzi was confirmed at HRT, and a discussion on the new rookies that are appearing this year in the How Do You Guys Fancy the New Rookies thread. The consensus was that there is not a great crop of rookies this year, with the possible exception of Daniel Ricciardo, who could get a drive this year at the expense of one of the Toro Rosso drivers. With the consensus, Buemi is most at risk. Details of the popular forum prediction competition are being finalized, with Scrutineer Yay and programmer Chemix calling for final submissions on the rules for the 2011 season. Entries will be opened up to first practice in Melbourne and should be PM'd via the forum pages to Yay. If you are interested in fantasy racers for 2011, Cyan has created a league named F1 Leaky for forum members. Full details can be found in the Fantasy Racers 2011 thread in the forum. Finally, a reminder, the popular Skype Quali and Race Chat will begin running this year, will again be running this year. Details can also be found on the forum closer to the Melbourne GP. That's it for this week's forum update. If you are not a forum member, drop in. We are a bunch of F1 fans who listen to the best F1 podcast on the internet and discuss all aspects of Formula One in a friendly, non-confrontational environment.
And we've had a lot of new members coming on board. We have over 1,120 members, Stephen.
Something's working. Hey, maybe we'll get to the point where we have like 3 times as many people as we have had podcasts.
That would be good. I like it, Steve. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much. Quickly, the San Francisco Formula One group, also known as SFF1.com. A great group of guys. They get together at a local bar and grill in San Francisco, eat, drink, and watch the races. So check them out on their website, SFF1.com, and I will announce whenever they have gatherings. Cameron Karting is proud to organize and support the 2011 Redline Oil Karting Championship. Cameron Karting offers CRG karts, engines, and parts for all karts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California karters. For more information, contact CameronKarting.com. I want to mention our Facebook and Twitter sites. Just do a search for F1 Weekly and as a friend. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, simply email me at info@f1weekly.com. There you have it, Steve. The season is about to start. We're excited. And of course, we will be doing our post-race podcasts as we do every season, Stephen. Are you looking forward to that?
Looking forward to it.
It's going to be fun. I'm telling you, you better get the Veuve Clicquot out because I have a funny feeling.
The Veuve?
The Veuve is going to be popped because Nick Heidfeld is going to surprise this season, Stephen.
I thought it was your job to bring the champagne when Renault wins.
That's true, and I will. There you have it, Steve. Okay, thanks for listening, and good night.
Good night.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, recording and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.